Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 261st episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's Awards podcast, which is now but one of four podcasts that comprise the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, the others being It Happened in Hollywood, Behind the Screen, and TV's Top 5. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today has had a professional journey unlike any other, morphing from one of the first YouTube stars to an internationally popular stand-up comedian to a filmmaker. He is currently the toast of Hollywood for his feature writing and directing debut, Eighth Grade, a dramedy about an anxiety-riddled 13-year-old girl during her last week of eighth grade, which proved one of the most critically acclaimed films of 2018, clocking in at 99% on RottenTomatoes.com, and a breakout art house hit, costing $2 million but grossing close to $14 million. He has been awarded the Bingham Rae Breakthrough Director Gotham Award, Best Directorial Debut National Board of Review Award, and Best First Film New York Film Critics Circle Award. He was nominated for the Best Original Screenplay Critics Choice Award, and he is nominated for the Best Original Screenplay Writers Guild of America Award and Best Screenplay Spirit Award, all for a film that cracked Best of 2018 lists from sources ranging from the National Board of Review to the American Film Institute to former President Barack Obama, and that may have more accolades still to come. Bo Burnham. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 28-year-old and I discussed the origins and implications of his accidental YouTube stardom, how performing comedy alone in his bedroom compared and contrasted to doing so in front of live audiences, how his own intense battles with anxiety motivated him to look for a way out of stand-up and ultimately to write Eighth Grade, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Bo, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Absolutely. We always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Born in Beverly Hospital, Massachusetts. Raised very near there in Hamilton, Massachusetts, 30 minutes north of Boston. My father works construction, and my mother is a hospice nurse.
Mm-hmm. And can you sort of paint a picture of your childhood generally, but also specifically where you might have been, what you might have been like in eighth grade yourself?
Oh, interior broom closet. No. Yeah, I mean, I had a pretty basic sort of childhood. I don't know. I think it was pretty, nothing too particular. Sports. I played sports a lot as a kid, did a little bit of theater.
Were you very tall even then?
No, I was much shorter. I started small,
yeah,
and then I got gradually taller. But I actually wasn't, like, in eighth grade, I wasn't actually even particularly tall.
Okay.
I'm 6'6", 6'7".
Right.
And this is actually me with stunted growth because I didn't hit puberty for a while. I was supposed to be like 6'10 or 6'11". Oh, yeah, so like, thank God. But eighth grade, I was sort of average. And then like sophomore in high school, I grew 7 inches. I had stretch marks on my spine from growing so quickly. Yeah, but it was like, it's pretty basic. And even eighth grade wasn't even like a seminal time for me. It wasn't like stressful. It was, sophomore year in high school is more when I started stressing out, but eighth grade is kind of sick.
Yeah, it's a good
but
time.
We didn't get to go to DC like all the other kids, all the other grades before me. We were the first year that didn't do the class trip to DC.
Why did you not get to go?
I don't know, because like, why were you sending eighth graders to Washington DC? Actually, like, eighth grade trips, that feels extreme. That feels like way too young for an entire class of people to go to somewhere else. Not even people, but children. That's the thing, like, when I was in schools, going back to these schools to shoot the movie, the thing that, like, struck me the most was, like, oh, my God, you do the kids realize how much they outnumber the adults? Like, you can't believe that order is maintained. And when you go back as an adult, I guess when you're a kid, you just, like, believe in the system enough for it to work. But going back as an adult, I'm like, there are, like, 12 adults and 1,000 kids in here, or there are like 3 adults in this room and there are 800 kids in an auditorium, like, let alone, like, you're gonna bring a class of whatever 300-400 kids to DC and they're gonna come back alive. That seems impossible.
Well, you mentioned that it wasn't until sort of junior year high school that you started to feel stress. Let's talk about that, because you've been very open about the fact that you battled with anxiety. That was a part of the motivation for doing eighth grade, the movie. But yet, what I don't understand is how a person who feels that way would still gravitate towards performing, which I understand you did at home, you did at school, even in something which I'll leave it to you to define, called competitive theater. Why would somebody who gets stressed out in the world choose to put themselves out in front of the world.
Yeah, competitive theater is basically a system in which young people compare the quality of capes. It just sort of cape thread count is sort of the competitive nature of theater. No, but yeah, no, I mean, I think a lot of anxious people are attracted to the arts. And I think a lot of people are anxious, period, too. I think anxiety is a pretty universal experience. I mean, not anxiety disorders, which I do feel like I in part have. I don't have a severe anxiety disorder, but I have had panic attacks. And that's something that not everyone in their life has had.
Well, and you were hospitalized not irregularly in high school, right?
Yeah, not hospital. I mean, hospitalized is probably an intense verb. We just thought I had stomach problems because every day of sophomore year, I just like be on the toilet. It was just because I was stressed because I was worried I was going to get like a B plus. I was a very sort of a problem school kid. Like I was very, very stressed about grades, very stressed about my schoolwork.
This is at like an all boys Catholic school.
Catholic high school that was very academically competitive. Right. And it was sort of like in this sort of awful way is like from your first class there. It's like, are you going to Harvard? Are you going to Harvard or not? Because everything that you every B you get means you're not going to Harvard. Every A minus you get means you're not going to Harvard,
right.
Which is so awful. And even to like, I did like work for 4 years to try to like go to Harvard or a school like that, which is like not to like better educate myself, but just so I could like get the sweatshirt and then say, I won, I'm smarter than you all. Like it's so bad. Like it's such a bad system to be in. And
for the record though, you did get into Harvard.
I did. yes. I am better and smarter than everybody. But it took me a long time to unlearn that sort of stuff. But that's kind of just America, right? Just like achieve or whatever. And or just like pursue things for the sake of the achievement and not for whatever it would be about. You know, there are like people should go to Harvard. I'm saying like people, but there are probably people that want to go there and better themselves and educate themselves. I shouldn't have went because I was only going there for the bumper sticker. And
but I guess even in high school, when you're feeling all the stress and, you know, as you're saying, part of it is just working to get into college. I don't know how much beyond that you were thinking, but were you at that point known as like a funny guy?
I think. I mean, I wasn't like a class clown person. Well, maybe I was. I don't know. I just think of the class clown as like a moron person. You know what I mean? Like, I just think of that someone like, I was probably just like with my friends privately more. But I was also a moron. And yeah, no, I thought it was funny. I mean, I loved theater. That's what I really loved. That was the thing in high school that I could feel like was pulling me towards if there was a higher calling. And not higher, I mean better. I just mean higher as in for me personally deeper. That like the way I was participating in this thing, even though of course I wanted to be really good in the plays and wanted attention.
But let's go back to that though. Because you, again, I don't think we addressed the fact. So you're feeling so stressed and social anxiety. I don't know if you could pinpoint what was driving that or what does drive that.
It was school at that time. It really was. Being it was out, stress. Like, it was just stress. But it was like, I would do theater, but I also thought like, of course I'm nervous. Like I'm about to like go on stage in front of 500 people and I'm 16. Like, I don't know who isn't nervous during that. So, and that's how I still sort of see it is that like, I don't think it's necessarily antithetical to it. It's, I mean, it definitely makes it difficult, but also like, I hope it's the very thing that makes me nervous, that makes me perceptive enough to participate creatively in the way that I do in the thing. So it was never, I never want to try to let on people that I suffer from severe anxiety disorder. I wasn't like crippled by this thing. Right. It was just, it was something that later crescendoed sort of in my early 20s. But in high school, my performance anxiety, quote unquote, my stage fright was very, very manageable and wasn't really, it was just, you know, regular old nerves. Then I was 23 and had a panic attack on stage. That was my first panic attack of my life was at 23. So, and for a lot of people, I think for men can be late in life. So I,
well, so back then, as you're looking ahead to your future a little bit, even perhaps thinking beyond college, what I understand on the one hand, maybe the idea of comedy in some form was on the radar, but it was also, it wasn't like that far ahead of being a pastor, right?
Oh, well, yeah. Oh my God, being a pastor. Yeah. I don't know at that age. I mean, that was when I was very, very young. By the time I was 16, I was on the cool, like, atheist train. Because I was like, I thought I was very cool.
What tipped the scale?
You just being 15 and thinking, like, you figured the world out or something.
Right.
But, no, when I was 7 or 8, I loved church and thought I could have wanted to be a priest. And just because they were the only people I saw that were, like, sitting around thinking all day and talking. And I just loved talking about that stuff. And it's something that, like, I probably do in my normal life too much, which is just like talking nonsense out loud, just trying to like think. It was the, it was sort of my first foray into deep thought, which a lot is for kids, like God. And I'm not saying God is exclusively for children at all, but like it's kind of in churches, the kind of the first time kids are allowed to think very deeply about things.
Mm-hmm. So what year were you born?
1990.
So you really did grow up with the era of the computer in the home and the internet, and eventually, I guess, cell phones have been a part of your...
I mean, I had like a Motorola, clunky Motorola phone in like seventh grade and like a Palm Pilot freshman year. Like, so, but smartphone was junior year or senior year of high school was the first. I remember, you know, the first iPhone came out when I was a junior in high school, and that's sort of the moment. That's when the internet is in your pocket. Yes. Truly the internet in the browser form is in your pocket.
And how do you think those aspects of things shaped you? Were you somebody who, growing up, was always on your phone or computer?
No, I mean, that, like, I was playing Snake or, like, texting. You know, like, the phone I had in middle school was not that much different than anything else. And the internet, like, I had Instant Message, which was its own thing. But Instant Message was on your computer. It wasn't on your phone. Right. Instant messaging, AIM or whatever, was like this little self-contained version of social media for a couple hours at night where you would, you know, have braver conversations than you would in real life. But it was so isolated. It really is like not until the thing I felt in the last 4 or 5 years working on my brain, and which I think is working on the country's collective brain, definitely was not around when I was a kid.
Right.
Definitely not. I really think like the big thing happened insanely when I was like 22.
That was what, probably the iPhone?
Twitter, Instagram, the Twitterization of all conversation and thought.
Yeah.
The central conversation of our culture being Twitter.
I love one thing you had said where essentially like the version of your doctor turning out to have been a smoker is going to be, you know, an adult.
Your shrink. You had a Twitter account. It'll be like that. It'll be like.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. My doctor used to smoke. Will be the same thing as like my shrink had a Instagram account where it's like, but that's the option you're given though. You're given like participate and be miserable, or don't and don't exist, like obliterate yourself.
Let's zero in on a very specific date, December 21st, 2006. You're 16, a junior in high school, still living at your parents' place, and I guess up in your bedroom. What motivated you to record a video called, quote, "My Whole Family Thinks I'm Gay," close quote, and upload this to this relatively new thing at the time called YouTube? What brought that about?
Well, I had something just so incredibly subtle and creatively airtight that I just had to express. A piece of media that I knew would age perfectly over the coming decades. But yeah, I mean, I was 16. I had written a funny little thing I thought was funny, and I wanted to show my brother who was at college, and there was this new thing called YouTube where you could share a video.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any like model for virality or whatever at the time.
What did it take technologically to record and share a video?
Camcorders on a stack of books. That's like what it was. And then like uploading it at 240p. It's like the most, it's such bad quality. No mic or anything. I mean, just using the external mic of the camcorder that's 15 feet away in my echoey bedroom.
Right.
And then it was like, I think like a week later, it had like 400 views. And then it was like, whoa, that meant like the people in my town had seen it. And then like 3,000 the next week because the next town had seen it. And then it was shared on this site called break.com. And it got 250,000 a day. And then it was like, what? And then it all of a sudden became abstract. And then...
Well, let's break it down a little more. Had you done cheeky songs before?
And I had done them backstage at my theater.
Yeah.
With my theater group, I would just play little songs that I had written. And I had been learning the piano for a couple of years. And I used to do this thing, which is so funny. It's like so against every rule of how you should post and optimize things on the internet. The way I would post my videos, I would write like 3 songs at a time, and I'd release 3 videos all in a day, like of 3 separate songs, and then another batch of 3, which is like what I loved about it. It was so pre-algorithm, so pre-optics, and now like everyone is like, no, post it at 9 a.m. Eastern or whatever, because this is the peak time for this and that.
Right.
And it was back in the day when we didn't know anything. And
but it really, for you, it wasn't like, I want a lot of people to see this. It was just a vehicle to get it to your brother?
No, that's probably disingenuous. Like, I of course wanted people to see it in the back of my mind, and I wanted fame like any American wants fame, or not any American, but certainly a large amount of us, you know, I'm part of the generation who, you know, the shift happened. I sort of made a television show about it where it was like around 2004, there was a switch of the number one answer for what do you want to be when you grow up was famous for kids. It used to be like a doctor.
What do you think triggered that? Reality TV?
Yeah, probably. Probably reality TV, which abstracted fame completely, which completely disassociated fame from the service provided that would make someone famous. Now you just are famous for being. So that's very interesting.
What makes this so interesting on a subtextual level, I guess, is that we are hearing, I think, very valid, legitimate criticisms of the internet and fame from somebody who became famous through the internet.
Mm.
So let's go back, though, to how close we came to that not happening, because that night, your sister, I guess, intervened.
You really dug into stuff. I don't remember any of these stories. No, I posted the video once and my mother made me take it down. And then I posted it again with some edits, which were correct. She probably saved me like an entire like press cycle during all this thing by taking my original videos down. Yeah, my mother made me take it down. As she should have. She didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing.
So as you said, that first YouTube video eventually really blows up thanks to being just picked up by this site, break.com. So that's another good lesson for people that, you know, you may not intend it to go everywhere, but it can. Things go viral. But that one, 250,000 views in a day, onwards from there. How did that affect your thoughts about YouTube? Were you now, I should keep doing this because it's getting a good response? Or what was your feeling at that point?
Yeah, I was like, I should write some stuff and keep posting it, I guess. And
your friends and, you know, classmates sort of knew you now as this guy, or what?
Yeah, kind of, but not really. My life didn't really change. That was the sort of immediately true thing that was like, oh yeah, these abstractly huge numbers on one hand and my life is the same on the other, which sort of continues to this day of just like the weird abstract way that fame or attention manifests in some ways and doesn't in others.
Right.
Looking back, I'm not proud of myself, but like I didn't lean into it in a way I could have. You know what I mean? Like I was, you know, I was a junior. I was offered like a very decent chunk of money for a junior in high school that had $100 in a savings account to write like a song for Carl's Jr.
Right.
And I like didn't do that. And I look back and I go like, yeah, you know, I'm like happy that I had like a little bit of integrity back then and know not to do that. But also I really, what I did know, which the one thing I'm very happy I knew back then, which is that like, even though I'm getting attention right now, I'm like, I'm nowhere in my creative journey. Like I'm just the beginning of, because you can see people on YouTube where they get attention for something they made when they're 16 and then now they're 30 and they've been
doing
the thing they were doing at 16.
Right.
And I knew that like, I'm getting attention for this, but like, I really need to grow.
Right.
I don't really know anything about this yet, about writing, about performing, about all those things, at the very beginning of sort of that journey.
Well, let's just, to, you know, keep it going chronologically. You continue to put up other comedic, often musically comedic videos dealing with everything from the KKK to Helen Keller.
Jesus
and and getting a good response. But what was the point where it did become professionally viable?
I mean, Jesus, 2006, bro.
I disavow. We're not judging.
Cannot speak
for others.
For people who judge. Yeah. It's unsurprisingly, Scott, you are not the sole voice of the current
believe
moment.
It or not.
Yeah,
right.
I'm saying. So disavow.
No,
I'm like Justin Bieber during his deposition. I don't recall.
That is stipulated. But you mentioned passing on the Carl's Jr. offer, but there was at some point
Carl Sr. I took with relish.
But like you did at some point, you're getting outreach from the business, right?
Yeah.
Of comedy and showbiz.
Yeah, what Doug Edley, who's still my agent.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
From my, like, I got an email to my school email account. Like, I'm an agent. He was at Gersh at the time.
Yeah.
And he's like, I represent Joel McHale. I'm like, cool. I like love Joel McHale. And he's like, I'm interested in you for, I don't know, it was more professional than this. The first thing ever was, oh my God. So that's probably 17. He said, come out to LA. Joel's doing a show and I think you should do a spot in his show. I never performed live ever. No. I had done one or two performances at the community house at my, like, you know, my
for
local
like
community
a couple
house.
Dozen people.
For like a dozen kids.
Yeah.
So we flew out to LA. We stayed at the Hilton Garden or whatever. It's I don't know. It's like, and Joel was doing a headlining show at the Melrose Improv. And I did a set, a 5-7 minute set. It's taped. It's actually taped.
Is it on YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
And you're 17, and how are the other comedians treating you?
I just remember incredibly kind. I remember, like, Joel was so, so kind. And it went okay. And then he sent me to open for Joel on the road. But actually, I did a taped gig in London as well. But which is stupid. My fifth time on stage.
But
like
you're,
a taped
what
set.
Are your
so
parents saying? Like, so you're still in school.
Well, my mother's saying, like, hang the towel back up. Because they'll change it over. Like, she's staying in the hotel with me.
Right.
Oh, she came out with me. And so, my father, I think.
So now, though, when you're getting at it's not even a legal age, you're being asked to come out and do things professionally for the first time. Was there a conversation like, this is crazy? Is this how you should be spending your time? Or
well, yeah. I mean, they're very supportive. Like, they're very just supportive. My brother, like, and my sister played sports a lot, and they would support their sports. So this is, like, my just version of sports. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were also – my mother was looking at, like, Hollywood. I don't know. This seems like – seedy, awful, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, like sketchy place for a child. And she was correct. But so she watched me, you know, right. they definitely like were there in the beginning.
And you signed with the agent?
Yeah. Or handshake. I've yet to sign anything
really?
With Doug,
okay.
But yeah.
But I guess the first
yes.
real professional opportunities are that I know there was this deal with Comedy Central, right?
Yeah, so, man, so I opened for Joel a bunch, like 5 or 6 times, which felt like a bunch to me. Mm-hmm. It was crazy, you know, 2,000 seat theaters or whatever, and him gig in Vegas and a gig in Boston. And
you're missing school for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was on the weekends of school, yeah.
Wow.
I would like driving down to Philly with my keyboard to play at this theater, the Keswick Theater. It's a beautiful theater. Making some money, yeah, definitely making some money. And then went to Just for Laughs after I graduated my senior year, July. Man, now it really feels like I'm like this old guy. It's so funny, like now recall these stories with so much distance that mm-hmm. I actually can recall them and not, you know, not have anything wrapped up
right.
in them. So graduated high school 2008 in June, went to Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal in July. So I was 17 and I met Judd there. Doing a show, and we got a little script deal going to make something, a sort of anti-high school musical thing. Mm-hmm. But I did a Comedy Central Presents, which is a half-hour special. Mm-hmm. I remember that was 3 days before my 18th birthday. That was very exciting.
Wow. And that led to what was actually a deal with them to do several things with them?
Yeah, just for, like an album, like a 4-album deal or whatever, right. which I think I've only done 2 of them. Jack Vaughn, though, at Comedy Central Records, a great guy's not there anymore.
We have to say you were the youngest comic ever to have a special on Comedy Central, right?
I would hope so. I mean, they shouldn't have given it to me, let alone anyone younger than me.
But I mean, this whole thing.
And that was literally my like 7th or 8th time on stage. That's what's so funny. It's so backwards and stupid and silly, but like, and like, if I saw that, I'd be so embarrassed. But, you know, I like to think I put in the work and my sort of 10,000 hours just after the fact. Right. Unfortunately, I got the audience first.
But we
and
can't
then I
gloss
put in the
over
time.
The fact that the thing that brought you to people's attention was comedy that you did in a room by yourself on camera,
yeah,
and that then the thing you ended up doing very soon after is a totally different art form of performing live in front of people.
Yeah, but there's something similar in terms of like I was not making films and posting them. They were uninterrupted one take, mm-hmm. a camera on the thing, and then I'd perform the song in 3 minutes and go over and turn the recorder off. So like the songs were performances in a way. I'm saying they weren't like it wasn't cutting to different angles and stuff. So they were very easily translatable to the stage. And what I think is nice, because I didn't cut my teeth in the stand-up club in front of an audience giving me immediate feedback, because I didn't cut my comedic chops with a constant, I like kind of didn't care what people thought a little mm-hmm. bit. And I kind of had the people that were into my weird little stuff that I don't know if they would have found me in a club. And so I still like when I would go and do my stage shows, I was thinking of them like I was performing them alone in a way. Like my stage shows, a theme of them or whatever is being alone, yeah. being isolated, having a disconnect from your audience, which I probably first had in the fact that they weren't
yeah,
there.
They weren't
I was
there.
Saying it to. And I like that about my stand-up, that my stand-up isn't just the distance between me and the crowd, I think, because I love stand-up comedy. I love stand-up comedy in comedy clubs. I love that type of comedy. But it tends to ask for specific things and get a sort of maestro party host type personality. Not always, but there's just like it's not the same as what I felt like I was doing, which was more close to the world of theater, which is sort of writing, creating something in isolation, rehearsing it, making it, and then showing it to a crowd. And then, as opposed to stand-up, which is like kind of being worked out with a crowd all the time.
Right. I guess as your professional opportunities in comedy were just starting while you were still in high school, you were literally simultaneously getting ready for SATs and applying to colleges. And we mentioned you got into Harvard, you got into Brown. It sounds like the one that you planned to go to was NYU Tisch. And
yeah, I actually signed up to go to that. Yeah.
And it was going to be experimental theater. So that
which
itself.
Is like, that is so sweet, my parents. Like, because legitimately, it was like, you know, we're not sitting on a ton of money, but it's like to go to NYU was 40 grand a year. To go to Harvard was like four because Harvard has such a huge endowment that they don't need to. They like don't need tuition or something. Right. And basically like you submit whatever the thing and they like just you can just pay kind of what you afford or whatever.
Right.
And it was like it was so much cheaper to go to the school that was.
But you were that committed to getting into experimental theater that the dream of Harvard was now secondary to doing
theater. For my parents to be like.
Right.
And I tell my mom like you should have told me like but they just trusted me and like knew I was passionate about it, which is so sweet and so, so kind.
So you graduated from high school, you said 2008. 2009 was the first stand-up special that you had on TV with the Comedy Central one, Words, Words, Words. 2000...
We're going very deep. We're glossing over some stuff. You want to go want to go over my virginity? We're really going step by step.
Well, to answer your first video's question...
Well, that's way, way, way. Virginity's way. Yeah. That's between Sundance and South by.
So 2009 was the first one. 2013 was the second one on YouTube called What? And then 2016 was the third one, Make Happy, on Netflix.
Was on YouTube and Netflix, which is very cool. Like, I went to Netflix and I was like, they're like, we'll give you this much money if you make your special here or whatever. And I said, what if I post it on YouTube as well for free? Can I do that? And they said, like, we'll give you half. And I was like, and it was cool. Like, covered the expenses of the special. So
why
was
it important to you to put it on YouTube?
I thought it was like some cool statement I was making and then no one noticed it. Like, everyone thinks that it, like, and it has like, my posted video of the show is like 10 million views or whatever. Right. But people just think it's like a pirated version of the thing. Right. Like the actual statement I was making, which is like, I'm going to post a special for free for YouTube. And I even didn't put any ads in the video, which again, no one noticed. Right. It was the lesson I learned that like.
So it wasn't like, let's give back to YouTube I came from.
Yeah, well, it was. It was like, I want to like put my whole special on there for free as a statement. But I'm saying it wasn't even seen as that because.
Right.
People don't even like notice what the username was or that stuff. Whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter. I also, with that special in particular, I just felt like I want this to be seen.
Yeah, it's smart because you knew that it does work that way with YouTube. You can go very far and wide quickly. But so those three stand-up specials on TV, plus you're still touring and doing live stuff like Edinburgh Comedy Festival, 2010 and 2013. But so 2010 was the first time you go there, I think. Mm-hmm. You won two awards, one of them, quote, act most likely to make $1 million, close quote. So it's obviously it was going well. But the second one in 2013, having already done at least one, maybe even the second of these filmed specials, you go back and I would think you would have had more confidence and self-assurance and whatever. And yet it sounds like that's where the onstage panic attack started.
Yeah, well, the Fringe is pretty isolated, specific experience that's pretty stressful. It's actually the only thing that's comparable to the thing I've been going through right now with the sort of award circuit thing, which is like the Fringe Festival. It's you know, 300 shows all battling for audiences. The first year I was in this place called the Pleasance, in a venue called the Queen Dome, which is a little 175-seat converted room that's converted into this little round theater. The way it works is you do your show, you get reviews, and there's a huge, huge mechanism for reviewing comedy in Europe, which there isn't over here. And it's why I connected to so much comedy over there. And I think that the actual system of review of comedy, which is very intimidating, obviously, also like dignifies comedy as an art form over there, where it really doesn't over here. Anyway, you know, you get these reviews, then what you do is you cut out your reviews, cut out your stars, and you put them on all your posters around the thing, and the good review shows get seen, the bad review shows don't. I had a really good run in 2010, which was nice. And then 2013, I got put into the 900 or 800 seat theater, the Pleasance Grand, the big place, and did a 10 run show there. So, you know, that's 8,000 tickets to sell in Scotland. You know, I go in there. I've only sold the first show. I've sold the first show out with everyone who's ever heard of me in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I have 9 shows the rest of the time that are either going to be full or empty based on the reviews that happen that first night, which I'm just sitting there and it's like, yeah, there's the reviewer for, you know, The Times and The Guardian and The Scotsman. And my show is at 11:30 at night. And the way the schedule of these things happen is the turnover of the shows are 4 to 7 minutes long. One show ends in 4 to 7 minutes the next show starts. And the show before me was a guy called The Boy with Tape on His Face, who's an incredible, I think he's New Zealand mime clown act, who has a piece of black tape over his mouth and does an entire silent comedy routine. It's amazing. And the end of his show was 99 red balloons played, and 99 red balloons dropped in the stage, and he did this whole thing, and it was a big... So I'm freaking out, you know, in this tiny, dark, in this dark 800-seat smoky room as I'm waiting in the 4 to 7 minutes between changing over the crowd to get my crowd in 11:30 at night to be reviewed to determine the next week of my life. All I'm hearing is, gah, 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 gah. My pre-show routine was the sound of balloons being violently popped to turn over for my show. So it was like some crazy sort of like knob experience.
Right.
I mean, I can also look back and go, I should have been like, you know, I could go bomb in Edinburgh and come back here and no one would really notice, you know. But it's very stressful. And that first night I had my first panic attack on stage because it's just intense. It's also just too much.
Like, take us in your head or your body or whatever. What does a panic attack on stage feel like?
Tunnel vision, zoom, just short of breath. It feels like you're just constantly trying to catch your breath and you can't. So like your words are like you're just fighting to catch the breath to say your words all the time.
Right.
Everything becomes incredibly abstract. You feel like you're sort of disassociating from yourself. You're like out of body and it's just weird. And then like the thing you want to do in a panic attack is go like, oh, okay, but instead you have to, in a show, I'm within a play that I've created, that every beat and word and gesture is written and planned. So I have to like continue through my own, this like virtual reality thing that I've made for myself. It's weird. And I didn't know what it was until months later. And I was like, oh.
And it continued through other live performances.
Yeah, I probably had 10 in my life, 10 panic attacks, 9 of which were on stage. And one of which was on a train from New York to D.C., between shows.
Triggered by anything or just...
Between shows. I was four shows into a 50-show tour, and I had had 2 panic attacks on stage already, and I'm like, I'm just like in for hell. I'm like, oh my God, I have 45 shows in the next 48 days,
right,
and I've already freaked out twice, and I just seen The Martian.
Well, so all of this, I guess, is what sort of leads up to, you know... 3 years later, the next special comes out, Make Happy, which obviously was recorded maybe even 2 years later, let's say, or whatever. And the
I said I'd quit. I said I was going to quit after what? And I wrote
Let's set it up a little more, though, because the last few minutes of that hour, there's an 8-minute auto-tune Kanye-style thing called Can't Handle This, which ends with you saying to the audience, quote, I can pretend my biggest problems are Pringle cans and burritos. The truth is, my biggest problem's you. I want to please you, but I want to stay true to myself. I want to say what I think and not care what you think about it. Part of me loves you, part of me hates you, part of me needs you, part of me fears you, and I don't think I can handle this right now. Close quote. You bow, you say thank you, you drop the mic, you leave the stage, and then you did not do stand-up again for how long?
2 years, probably.
And that was tied to not wanting to subject yourself to the panic attacks, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't have fun. It wasn't fun anymore.
But I guess even well before that, 2014, you were already at that point starting to write what became Eighth Grade. So were you looking for a way out of stand-up?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I wrote Eighth Grade sort of the month after What premiered. And I was like, I don't want to do stand-up anymore. So I wrote Eighth Grade, and I tried to sell it, and it wasn't happening. And then the special did really well, and it was like, shoot, I kind of finally got the ticket sales that I always hoped I would get to play the venues I always wanted to, which was theaters, legitimate theaters. Like, when I was doing my What tour, I couldn't sell theaters. I could sell small theaters, 800-seaters and stuff, but I couldn't do the real theaters that I wanted to do. And not that I wanted to do, I mean, I was terrified, but the scale of the show I wanted to build was a show that was built for a 1,500 to 2,000 seat theater. And the special worked, and I could finally sell 2,000 tickets in basically every market. So I was like, all right, I'll do one more. Like, I'll do one more show, and I'll build this show, make the show I've always wanted to make, which is a comedy show that does not work in a comedy club, that does not make sense in any place smaller than 1,000 seats. Mm-hmm. So I did that last push, and I'm very happy with that special. Like, that special, there are parts I'm not too happy with, but I'm glad I did that. And I also was like, I'm going to finally talk about it. I'm going to make a show about my anxiety, about my struggle with doing this, as if that's going to fix it. Of course it doesn't fix it. But yeah, so I'm glad that happened. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the eighth grade was written before that was written.
And that's another way to work through, or at least grapple with anxiety, right?
Yeah, they're very similar. My last special in eighth grade are similar. Yeah. I think they were sort of written in the same time, actually.
Well, so the question that obviously you've probably gotten more than any other is, why did you decide to center your film on a 13-year-old girl as opposed to, say, a 20-something guy like yourself who's going through his own version of the same thing?
The truth of, like, I was so bored with myself. And, like, another thing about a comedian being sad, like, I'm so bored of that. For me personally, it's, like, the most boring subject in the world. And I tried writing something about, like, a 25-year-old guy living at home with his parents. And it was just, like, man, it became, like, just dark and, like, unlikable and boring, kind of. And, like,
there were a bunch of characters, right?
Well, that's another thing. But, I mean, I tried to do the... I wrote like a pilot of me, kind of, but not me. But like, I tried to write just like a thing about a angry young man or whatever, mm-hmm. or whatever it was. Yeah. And then I tried to write a bunch of other stuff. And then it was like, I wrote her and then stumbled on her. And it was like, oh, this is everything. This is probably everything I'd want to say. But it was never like, I should write a girl, or I was writing a boy. I was like, let me make it a girl. It was like, mm-hmm. She just kind of appeared fully formed, not fully formed, but as fully formed as something can be in the script process before it's embodied by an actor.
You said again, you were born 1990. Yeah. So you're 24 when you start writing this, 23. So you're even in the 10 years since you had been 13, the experience of a 13-year-old, much less, or, you know, not to say nothing of a 13-year-old girl, had changed immensely. So how do you go about knowing and then kind of capturing what a 13-year-old girl sounds like years after you're even in that demo?
Yeah, I mean, I had no interest in retracing my own steps, so I never consulted my past experience or memory for this. Really, I mean, of course I did at some level when we're like, you know, on the day and there's like sniffable markers and stuff. I'm definitely like, memories are coming back, but like, I didn't care about my eighth grade experience. I did not care about, for me, 2003 when I was in eighth grade, right, and all that stuff like that, with no interest. So I consulted the real kids talking online. I mean, I saw videos of 13-year-old kids, a lot of them girls, expressing themselves in sort of 10-minute uninterrupted soliloquies online with subject lines like, you know, how to be yourself or how to live life. And I saw them performing themselves in public in a captured medium. And I thought, this is it. This is what it means to be alive. This is the modern struggle. This is the central character of the current moment for me, is a 13-year-old girl presenting her soul in a weird performative way online and then trying to square that with her lived experience, which is probably, you know, for this particular girl who is, you know, middle class, white, her experience is pretty banal, and that's sort of what she's having to square. But that felt like, I don't know, it was just in and of itself compelling to me. I didn't really have to, in any way, you know what I mean? I didn't have to go like, it was like I was writing about an astronaut or something, where it was like, that's how I viewed it, where I was just like, this is just incredibly fascinating. I just want to be true to this experience. I feel like I understand her on a deep level, but it was current and real. I related to her currently.
But even, you know, right down to the fact that here's somebody who is turning to YouTube for, in some ways, attention, right?
Yeah, I know. And that's probably made its way into there somewhere, but I never thought of myself at 16. I think the way she is online is so different than the way I was online at 16. And I think what online it was in 2006 right, is so different than what it was now. For me, the way she is online is so much more similar to the way I am right now in this interview than the way I was in 2006. The way I relate to her is so much more my current need to present myself to the world in a certain way than my 16-year-old's presentation of some funny skit he was doing to be famous. I don't know that she wants to be famous. Like, she wants to just be, like, recognized, and she just wants to exist. She just wants to exist and she's told that that's how she exists. I had much more of like a, I don't know, I was doing something much more quote unquote artistic, and I don't mean that in a better way. Like, I was playing a game trying to get something. She's like being. There's a way kids are online now, which is similar to us, where it's like there is no end game. It is just like be, just like to be or not to be. It like really is. I mean, I do think that like.
Well, the way you've talked about it, another thing I saw, what I thought was pretty great. You said, quote, the problem is we are hyper-connected and we're lonely. We're overstimulated and we're numb. We're expressing ourselves and we're objecting ourselves, close quote. Just basically that this idea that what we think we need to do and what almost everyone does do is actually very detrimental to all of us, right? I mean, it's not a healthy, probably, situation for any of us. Whether it's too soon to know the long-term implications.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, we can take inventory of the short term and realize that I don't think any of us are happy. And the problem is, yeah, it's really tough right now. I don't know what's happening. And it's like, I think the problem might be the mediums, or, well, the problem is obviously certainly deeper than the mediums, but the fact that we're trying to solve the problem through these mediums is really difficult. That's what makes it crazy. You know what I mean? It's like you got Trump tweeting and then people trying to tweet Trump out of office. And it's like, wow, I wonder where that's going to lead. You know, I mean, like, these systems are designed only for engagement. That's all they want. They don't want conversation to get healthier. They don't want things to get better. They don't want us to get along. They want us to engage. Just engage, engage, engage. They just want your time, your attention, and your focus. That's all that these things are trying to get from you. And it's not because it's evil people twiddling their mustaches. And that's what we're asking for. We've made a world that's tweetable. You know, that's, of course, there's a lot of things that led to Trump and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But part of it feels like we just, like, the system called for someone that would make us tweet all day about him. It's sort of the backwards thing of, like, the late night sort of comedy, like, satirical news. I felt like there was so much satirical news that at some point that the satirical news was such a heavy burden on the culture that it was actually, like, begging for the most satirizable news. So it got it. Like, congrats.
Here we are, yeah.
Congrats, news satire. You got your softball right down the middle. And, like, geez, it's like... Right. I don't know what that's actually concretized in our culture is actually asking for solution. I don't know what's calling for it other than the people, other than every actual person, you know, in private conversation or together. It's just like, it's really hard. It's tough, let alone to be like a child just trying to navigate your own inner experience, you know, and that was the way to, I thought that I was going to have to go after all these questions in those big ways. And the more I sort of engage with the questions in these big ways, and I can do it here all day, you know, in a fun way, just sort of BSing about it. But I realized that the better way to go after it was just subjectively and to talk about a small subjective experience of all of this, nightmare, of this chaos rather than.
But is she emblematic of, like, our millennials?
She's Gen Z. I'm a millennial.
Okay. So she,
that is a common misconception.
Yeah, where's the line?
Yeah, so millennials are basically born 1980 to 1995 is the general idea. She's born in 2003, 2004. Like, she is definitely post-millennial. They call them post-millennials, Gen Z, or iGen, which I hate. Right. iGen's so corny, but that's the irony of all this stuff is that the generational names are always named by the previous generation, you know? So they're always, like, out of touch.
Choice, a say in the matter, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But, okay, so let's just say, though, from millennials, which I guess is that based on your timeline encompasses me and you, onwards, so including her, are we a different breed than the people before us? Because, I mean, just for instance, this week, to give the example that everybody's talking about this week, we've had two documentaries come out. I don't know if you've seen either yet.
I saw the first. I'm excited for the Netflix.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm definitely watching both. Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, it doesn't reflect very well on us. But would that have happened had any, is it just, it's specific to the times in which we came out? I mean, basically, we are depicted as narcissistic, materialistic, and clueless about the world. It's hard to know. Does that truly define a majority of people of this era?
Yeah, well, I mean, I also think that's... Fire Festival's attracting... I mean, it's like a dog whistle for the worst type of person ever. Which I would say the worst type of person is the person going to Firefest ironically.
Right.
I would actually say that's the worst type of person in our culture, is the person that's going to roll their eyes and also participate in the thing, which is so widespread now I can't even...
Well, that was the influencers were doing that, right?
But but it's even worse than it. It's like the cool people that think they're above everything and also participating in it, which is like actually like the only path towards being cool for like my generation and the generation below me is to like ironically shit on bad things. It really, really depresses me.
Right.
But no, I don't know. I mean, I think we're probably all those things. I think we're probably, you know, at least in part, proliferation of means that a lot of our generation more than others are sort of probably clueless, privileged idiots. I also think a real problem with the moment is visibility. I mean, it's also the great thing about the moment, but sometimes we damn the current moment based on what's visible.
Right.
And if we had had visibility to previous moments in the culture, we would have realized how absolutely awful those things are. And everyone's like, you know, it's like, oh man, racial tension is the worst it's ever been, which is like, of course there has been some severe step backwards in the last few years, but it's also like, we are just getting, I think, white people are just finally, in certain ways, aware of things they had never been aware of. Right. And they're finally actually getting, you know, it's like everything was just fine 20 years ago.
Where
it's like,
was police brutality? Oh, yeah, now we have cameras.
Exactly. So I think part of it is visibility and just, and it's a lot to process. We're finally like, it's so strange, and it's again why it's like my stupid little thing about hyperconnected and lonely. It's like we are as visible as we ever have been, and we are as distorted at the same time. Like we are seeing more than we've ever seen, and we're also completely warped, and it's wild. It's so far beyond anything. Like when I go back and read, like, you know, interesting cultural critics or people that were like wrestling with television and, and these new mediums, like, so many changes happen so quickly. We haven't processed any of them.
Right.
It's so complicated. And the way it like interfaces with our culture and our conversation, the way we see ourselves is so complicated. And when I really try to think about it, I'm like on the floor, confused.
Well, no, the film helps to kind of make you think about it. But I guess I want to just ask a few logistical things before we go. So in terms of the writing of this, there are elements here that, you know, were, sounds like, somewhat drawn from your experience, like maybe the time capsule or things like that, right?
It's so funny. It's like, as I made this show for MTV, and it was called Zack Stone's Gonna Be Famous. It's like this little like mockumentary thing, and I was really, really proud of it. And I hadn't watched it in a long, long time. Me and my girlfriend, she's been with me since I made that show.
Yeah.
Like 6 months ago, we're like, we should throw it on. Like we haven't seen it in so, so long. So I throw in an episode and Zach takes out a time capsule, like a shoebox, on the 11th episode. I'm like, why is this stuff still appearing?
Recurring.
He takes out a shoebox, opens a shoebox. And in that same episode, there's this skit where he goes like, where they're eating dinner and it's like this fake scene of eating dinner and the fake lines are like, your eggs are getting cold. I like them that way. And in the movie, he says, your dinner's getting cold. She says, I like it that way.
Wow.
I'm going like, oh my God, like what the hell? Like I'm obsessed with time capsules and like intentional cold food. It's like so funny.
So when you sat down to write this, did you know exactly where it was going when you started? Had you outlined, or was it sort of like, let's see where this leads me?
Definitely not. Yeah. I only sat down to write to enjoy writing. I was at the sort of that dark place we were talking about in my life, and I wanted to enjoy writing. So I didn't even sit down thinking like, I'm going to make a movie. I'm going to direct a movie. I was like, I'm going to go to this coffee shop for 2 hours. I'm going to enjoy doing what I'm doing. I'm going to just enjoy this. So I would sit down and write just what would be fun to write,
right?
Not to make, just to enjoy writing. And I started writing this. And I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, I'm not going to worry about connecting this stuff or stressing myself out with structure or any of that. I'm just going to write something that would excite me. Man, if she went to a pool party, boom, and it just was exciting. Okay, she's in a drill and she has to talk to this kid. And then, you know, I got probably 60 pages into it and we're like, okay, this is like something, and there's a direction here, and there's clearly like this, there's definitely an order that these scenes should probably be in, and now what is the structure? And I had these videos as well, and when I found the time capsule, it was like, okay, that's the movie. Like that was weirdly the thing that made it, that actually gave the movie structure.
Oh, that's great. And then I guess the other kind of obvious question is, you had done some directing before in the sense that you'd done Gerard Carmichael's special, which led to the Chris Rock special that you directed. But that's very different than directing a feature narrative film. Even if it's, I think, $2 million budget, it's not going to drive somebody out of business here if it didn't work. But like that, Who had to buy into you as a director for that to happen?
I know. Well, it was A24 and Scott Rudin who kind of came on at the same point. I had talked to A24 early when they were just a distributor, which, of course, like your new moment, was like my dream company for this film. And they were like, we'll distribute it if you get money. And then I didn't get money for so long. They actually became a financier in the meantime. And it was funny because Scott Rudin says, like, this was so not part of the argument, or like so not part of why they came on board. But I had tried to get a little make happy that previous special had just come out, and I had sold, you know, however, 100,000 tickets or whatever on the road that previous year. And I was able to go like, okay, if just these people buy the tickets to the movie, you'll get a little bit of your money back. So like, I can already prove to you that at least some of this is recoupable. But Scott says like, no, he just read the script and was like, this seems good. And
but still, maybe believing in you as a director is a different thing than loving the script.
Yeah, yeah. The truth is, it was a risk, and I'm incredibly grateful for taking the risk, because a lot of people did not want to take that risk.
Right, but then you get there and obviously prove that you were able to do it, and I think something like the pool scene where you have everything from the music thumping when she sees the cuter kid to the tracking shots, all it's very cinematically skilled for somebody who, you didn't go to film school, you didn't make other short films as far as I know before. So like, just literally, how did you know what to do when you had to direct?
Well, I mean, relying on my collaborators for sure, Andrew Wade, my DP, and my producer, Chris Storer, and a lot of people. But part of it was just like, maybe just believing that I could do it was, you know, part of it, not being too intimidated. I did get the green light like 8 months before we shot, because we had to shoot in the summer because it was a kid's movie and it was going to like double the budget to shoot during the school year. So I had 8 months to read, you know, a book a week and watch three movies a day. So there was some stuff I needed to, there's a lot of stuff I still need to learn technically. I'm very behind technically, but I had confidence in at least my ability to work with actors. I felt like, you know, and coming from the world of theater and making the specials, like I tried to make my specials like films, and I tried to introduce some film grammar into my specials. And I do believe that like making stuff prepares you to make stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had made stuff before. I had visions at least of what a thing would feel like, and that I had made something, and I had realized, okay, that's how you can make it appear like this. That's how you can't. And I definitely have a ton to learn about filmmaking. Like, I have a lifetime, hopefully, left to learn about filmmaking.
Last couple minutes here, I just want to power through, if we can, just a few other things that I'm sure people are wondering if they're listening, and specifically Elsie Fisher, who plays Kayla. Where'd you find her, just having just finished Eighth Grade herself? I mean, she's excellent in it, to the point where I think it actually made me feel anxious watching it, that she's living these moments that obviously are, you've so empathized for her.
I found her online. I saw a video of her being interviewed for something. I don't know what it was. And I just kind of was like, this is exactly what I think. It wasn't like what I pictured. I like weirdly, so arbitrarily, like I thought she had brown hair. You know what I mean? It's like all this stupid stuff. But it was immediately like, this is what it sounds like to me. I didn't know if she could act. She came in, she was the second person in the room, and she really could act. And it was never anybody else. I mean, I saw 100 kids after, but it was always her. Never a second choice.
And
never.
Was it with her, you know, let's take for instance her vlogs. It feels so real and natural. Is that totally scripted, or do you give her permission to improvise a little bit, or how does that work?
It's pretty much scripted. I mean, we give her permission to stumble if she needs to, or not to be exactly word perfect, but the script is written. So the thing about being yourself is I'm reading this off a piece of paper. Sorry. Oh, okay. Huh. All right. So yeah, it's much more scripted than it appears. It definitely isn't improvised.
What is Gucci, man?
That's Elsie's little thing. Elsie did that on set all the time, would say that after she'd be like, I'd be like, how you doing today, Elsie? She'd be like, Gucci, and put her little hand up. And then we filmed the videos last, so I was like, oh, it should be her sign-off. Yeah. So it's hers, yeah.
So this movie gets done, gets into Sundance. I guess you were tinkering with it till right before.
Yeah, we were coloring it. We finished coloring it the Tuesday, and then we premiered on a Friday.
On a Friday. So it gets seen, goes over so, so well. I think it's still maybe the most or the second most well-reviewed movie of the year, according to Rotten Tomatoes, or whatever. All this stuff, all the recognition that's come. Does any of that cure the anxiety?
Of course, all of it does. I'm better now. No, I mean, truly, like, talking about it certainly does, you know, like, you know, like, certainly does. No, yeah, I mean, it feels great. I mean, it definitely doesn't help the anxiety of making another film. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I wish we could have hit a middle mark where I could have yes, gotten a good enough response to justify making another film, but also not for it to be an inevitable comparative failure.
Right.
But no, it's great. I mean, it's wild. You know, it's like, I mean, I had a 10-year at least run where I feel like I finally got invited to the party, and it's very strange because I like never was. I was always just on the outsides doing my own weird little thing, right, and sort of was never
embraced by the establishment.
Yeah, never. I was just never written. You know what I mean? Like all these, right, you know, like these sites or these, you know, right, everyone, you guys, like I was never really on that radar ever, you know?
Right.
So that's strange. But, you know, I found the people to be just as weird and sad as I am. Well, you know what I'm saying? It's like I went this like, oh my God, like the terrifying world of film. And I mean, I'm like, oh, like these are my people. Right. I mean, much more than I thought they'd be. I thought they were going to be highfalutin.
Does this mean that film is exclusively the future, or will there be more stand-up?
I think I might do some stand-up. I want to. It's pretty enticing right now just because it like seems so hard to do stand-up right now that it seems exciting to do again.
Final question. Yeah. You are obviously so good at identifying and then talking about the oddities and eccentricities of a situation, right? So we're seeing that with Eighth Grade and what it's like to be a kid and all of that. Can you do the same right now about what it's like to be in what award season is like?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the central probably irony of the entire thing, just in the politicized moment, mm-hmm, is probably people in golden rooms criticizing our president for being in a golden room. You know what I mean? Like, that's like the thing that makes me a little crazy. I'm like, right, all right, we're going to like go after Trump when it looks like Trump was like the interior decorator of all these like award shows that we're at. Like that to me is always a little wacky. I just didn't know how many there were. It's like wild how many there are. So that's pretty crazy. But it's, you know, it's nice. I mean, it's nice. I'm like friends with Paul Schrader. Like, that's very funny. Like, it's like very funny how many times I've like seen Paul Schrader. I'm like, Paul, hey, how are you? Like, Paul and I have been at like so many luncheons together, which is like not at all how I thought my life would turn out. But it's good. You know, I mean, like the real thing you do is like, I would have thought by this point, and it's probably very convenient for me to say this now that I'm here, you know, that I'd be like rolling my eyes going like, man, awards are bullshit. You know what I mean? But it's like, truly, when you actually make an independent film and you see the state of the world and people's attention, you realize like this is the only thing we have to get these films seen by people. And I have seen people reach out to me. I've seen people online that have seen the movie because of the awards attention it gets. And like, people don't realize it's like, yeah, well, is this Hollywood patting itself on its back? Sure. But it's like, it's also like the only thing that is promoting eccentric, strange things to be seen by who would have, like, people are going to see like Burning, mm-hmm, and Cold War and like all these movies that they like would not have seen had it not been recognized by, you know, the St. Louis Chronicles Golden Goose Awards or whatever they're called.
Or the Barack Obama Top 15 list.
Yeah, that's very good.
That was a good one for you guys.
But so like that is legitimate. And right, I also realized that like going into like the person that's, no one is taking the awards more seriously than the person in the back going, these are bullshit. Like that, like you are taking it way too seriously then. Like, and that's right. Just to go and like have a sense of humor, right, you know, I of course I care. Of course I'd want to get nominated for an Oscar. Who the heck wouldn't want? I mean, like, I'm like kidding myself and say I wouldn't want to. So it's like, have a little fun.
Right.
Care because it's fun to care. Right. It's like fantasy sports. I mean, right, who doesn't want to get, you know what I mean? Who doesn't want to like, and it's also like fun for my parents and stuff to, yeah, you know, I mean, they can text me a little less about it. My father can probably turn off the Google alerts at this point. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's very easy to be cynical about it because right, it's so obviously
right,
cynical. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, it really is about the work. It is about the, and like, whatever I can do to get this movie seen, I want it to be seen. Whatever that means. So I really, really appreciate it. Because this movie would have died. And not died, but like, people are still talking about this movie and seeing it in January. And that's because of this circuit. So I'll go around and do whatever. And people are people, too. Right. And you know, if it's at a PGA screening, it's still just people coming up and shaking your hand and saying they like the movie or they're engaging it on this part. You know, so like, they're all just excuses to talk to people about the film and the work, and that's all that. So it's great.
Well, thank you for doing
that. Was that a good?
That was great. Section.
Is that a fair political?
I think so.
Does it show that?
Hey, Oscar, the voting's over.
Does it show that I'm ready for Oscar season? Yeah, exactly. Right, it's already over here. Thank
Thanks a lot. Yeah, appreciate it.
Peace.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.